Hello, I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. Every once in a while, we have a guest on this program. When I read their book, find out about their lives, I have to take a look at my own. And when I take a look at my own in the light of people such as our guest today, kind of seems like I've been wasting my time. I mean, the whole time, because there are some people who truly are world changers. And the gentleman that we're going to have on our show today is in fact that. And I don't use that term lightly. Someone whose actions in this world and consciousness in this world actually changed the way people live. In his case, he changed the way people live by allowing them to live. Because Larry Brilliant is one of the key people who eradicated smallpox. Yes, eradicated smallpox. And he has such an amazing story. We are thrilled to have him here. Larry's book called Sometimes Brilliant, The Impossible Adventure of a Spiritual Seeker and visionary physician who helped conquer the worst disease in history, is here. And let me tell you a little bit about this amazing life. Larry Brilliant, MD, is a pioneering physician, visionary technologist, and a global philanthropist. He's a medical officer for the UN's World Health Organization and a member of the central team in smallpox eradication in India. He was the first executive director of Google.org and currently serves as the chairman of Skoll Global Threats Fund. Larry co-founded the SEVA Foundation, whose programs and partners have restored sight to more than 4 million blind in dozens of countries. He has worked with four presidents, the UN, G8, and chaired the National Biosurveillance Advisory Subcommittee. He co-founded one of the first digital social networks, The Well, and he resides in Northern California, from where he is speaking to us today. And Dr. Larry Brilliant, welcome to Common Threads.
Oh, Fred, thank you so much. Thank you for inviting me.
You know, what's fascinating about your life, as you have presented it in this book, is that if people don't believe in reincarnation, they're going to, because you've had so many lives in one body. and I could probably do an entire show on each incarnation. So what we're going to do is we're going to start a little close to the beginning and work our way towards some of the most important work that you've done, that anybody could have done. First of all, you know, we do share a commonality, and I should have said this when I introduced you, that you are a Michigan native.
Oh, go blue, perhaps, or just Wolverines.
either one is fine. Not only from Michigan, of course, we're speaking to West Michigan right now, but I'm from the Detroit area as well. And
well, which part?
Well, I'm going to tell you. I went to Mumford for swimming lessons and driver's ed.
Oh, and of course I went there for driver's ed and swimming, but I also went there to high school.
I know. You mentioned that in your book. So we could not have lived too far apart. You have a couple of years on me, but we probably hung out not too far away from each other. What part were you? What neighborhood or what street?
Right near 7 Mile Road, North Lawn, and I think my main claim to fame is that, of course, 8 Mile Road is the demarcation, but 7 Mile Road is where the University of Detroit, a Jesuit high school, Jesuit college, was located, and I used to sneak on to the premises of that high school in order to use their baseball diamond, because they had the best baseball diamonds.
Okay.
I could say that I went to a Jesuit high school. It's not exactly true, but I did go there.
Well, I was actually right off of 7 Mile, just a little bit east of where you're talking about. My brother went to University of Detroit High School.
I could not reach those academic heights, unfortunately, back then. I was a stupid kid.
I had trouble reaching the heights of the chain link fence to jump over to play baseball there.
Well, it is nice to speak with someone who shares a little bit of geographic history. Yeah, I was 7 miles between Livernois and Woodward.
So
the first part of where you start, you know, your childhood, and you have an incredibly interesting family, particularly your father, because he sort of walks that line. You know, he's got connections. Tell us a little bit about that interesting episode in your life, growing up in a family where your father, he's in the jukebox business, mm-hmm. right? And he has to deal with a whole different element of society than most business people. Although in Detroit, my family was in the restaurant equipment business. We dealt with some of the same people your father dealt with.
Same people, probably the same people.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, my dad, I'm a first generation American. My dad was born, his passport said he was born in Russia, but we're pretty sure that he was born in Belarus. In fact, that he was born in a little village halfway between Minsk and Pinsk. And his father took him and his mother out of the way of the Tsars, who were having pogroms at the time. This was even before the communist revolution in Russia. And they, for some reason, most of the immigrants that came from Central Europe and Eastern Europe, most of them would come to go to New York or Chicago. But for some reason, they came right to Detroit. And my dad arrived in a pretty tough part of Detroit when he was about 7 years old. He grew up and never graduated from high school and quickly was put to work by the gangs. And the gangs in those days were of two kinds. There was the mafia, which was Sicilian or mostly Italian. And then there was a Jewish gang. And my dad was part of this Jewish gang. Part of it is probably too big, but, you know, he hung around the edges as a young kid. And they put him to work collecting money that the residents would put into the lotto. Of course, there wasn't a lotto. It was legal. And it was called the numbers racket, and he was running numbers, and that's what he did to keep himself alive. And then he became a boxer, a street fighter, and eventually became a real boxer, and kind of grew up around the very same gyms that Joe Louis grew up in. Quite a different level of proficiency, I might add, but around the same place.
And This business that he got in, jukebox, this was kind of mobbed up. Is that correct?
Yes. So I think he started off probably working just like he had done running numbers. He started, you know, doing routes for Nickelodeons in those days, as they were called, picking up bags of nickels. And eventually he bought one or two of those routes. And if your family was doing restaurant supply, your family was probably calling on the same restaurants and bars that my dad was. If you were putting in the ovens and the stoves and the tables, he was probably putting in the jukebox.
Absolutely,
the same kind of.
Absolutely, yeah. It wouldn't be out of the realm of possibility. Some of this was happening in the 50s.
Exactly.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Wouldn't surprise me at all if he knew some of my family members. Yeah.
The difference was that the jukebox is a cash business. And as a cash business, what is the joke? It created imperial entanglements, and the mob always wanted to be in a cash business, and so they were always pushing him to sell his route to them, and he was building up his route, and so he had a clash. His ethics, as we were growing up, were pretty strict. I mean, for a guy who grew up on the streets, who was part of the prize fighting world, and a very tough world, and for somebody even then who always carried a gun, which is a strange thing in retrospect for me, He was just absolutely truthful all the time. And I don't think he would have recognized the term radical transparency, but he really was that. And his, of course, his grandparents were Orthodox Jews in Russia, and he came to America determined to be a modern man. He became a Reformed Jew, the first person in any of our families that ever wanted to assimilate, as he desperately wanted to assimilate. And he kept a very strict code of ethics, and people loved him. He was so, you know, we would go to hockey games, the Detroit Red Wings, and he would always, you know, get us seats so that he could go to the penalty box and get a broken stick from Gordie Howe or Ted Lindsay and give it to his boys, and everyone knew him there. And then we go to the Detroit Tiger games, and everyone knew him there. And wherever we went, even on, you said, on Woodward, I remember distinctly walking down Woodward. It was called the Golden Mile then, and we didn't go, you know, like two blocks without five, six, seven people crossing over the street, say, "Hi, Joe, how are you?" I grew up with the feeling that was normal, that people would cross the street to say hello to my dad. It was really nice.
That's great. Now, as you became older, you became a hippie, and a lot of people joined the hippie movement because they were rebelling against what they saw, the life they saw their parents leading. You paint your father, and I believe from the book that you also had a great affection for your mother as well. What were you rebelling against?
You know, there was an intervening variable for me. I probably would have eventually rebelled against the materialism in our culture, and particularly the materialism at the, you know, I didn't go to a synagogue, I went to a temple, Temple Israel in Detroit. I probably would have eventually rebelled against the materialism there. But intervening, my dad got cancer and was dying when I was a sophomore at the University of Michigan, and I was very depressed. I didn't have any inner resources to deal with that. I don't think anybody does when you're 17 or 18. And one day I saw a little ad in the newspaper that said Martin Luther King was going to speak at the University of Michigan. And I had kind of locked myself in my room at South Quad. It was a terrible day. It was raining. As you know, in Ann Arbor, sometimes the rain does not go vertically. It goes horizontally, and you can't really walk easily against it. And I was feeling really sorry for myself. But somehow I got out of bed, I walked in the rain, and I went to Hill Auditorium, which would normally have room for 3,000, 4,000 students. But because of the rain, and because Martin Luther King was not well known yet, had not won his Nobel Prize, there had not been the Mississippi Summer, there were, I don't know, 80 or 100 or maybe 200 people there. But the hall was empty. And Dr. King looked around, laughed, and said, "That'll mean there'll be more of me to go around." And he said, "You all come on up on stage." And I did, and many of us did. A lot of people were too shy, and we were kind of huddled all around him, either on stage or in front of him. And that's when I changed. In that moment, I was infected with the virus of activism. He told me that the world was unjust. I didn't know that, really, in my bones. He told me that the arc of the moral universe bends towards justice. I didn't know that there was something that was so much of a verb about history that it really changed. And then he said, "But it doesn't bend towards justice on its own. You got to get off your ass, jump out of your chair, leap up, grab that arc, bend it, twist it, and pull it down to justice." And that's what we all have to do. And I didn't know that there was something I could do. So I didn't know that really that there was a time change. I didn't know that the world was getting better. I didn't fully understand how unfair it was. And I certainly didn't know that it was possible for a 17-year-old kid from Mumford High School, first-generation kid, to do anything that would make it better. And so that moment is what changed me. Before I became a hippie, I became a radical, an activist. I joined SDS and SNCC and CORE and the NAACP and an alphabet soup of anti-war, civil rights organizations. And that's how I spent all the time in college and then in medical school. I spent all of my time marching, building free clinics. I must tell you that I was called the Phantom at Wayne Medical School because I hardly ever showed up at class because I was building free clinics. I was marching. I was lucky that my professors and especially my dean understood that. And my mentor, Ben Spock, was pretty notorious for that. And I think I got away with not coming to class a little bit more than probably is a good idea.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Common Threads here on WGVU-FM. I'm Fred Stella, and today my guest is Dr. Larry Brilliant, and we're talking about his book, Something Brilliant, The Impossible Adventure of a Spiritual Seeker and Visionary Physician Who Helped Conquer the Worst Disease in History. Yeah, I was going to ask you about Dr. Spock. That's, of course, a wonderful connection to have had in your life. And I think that later on, in the later 60s and 70s, he got a bad rap. Tell me if you agree or not, that people sort of blamed him. They looked upon, say, our generation, but more even your part of the generation, as spoiled brats. You've heard that criticism before?
I'm not going to defend that we were spoiled brats, because that's probably absolutely true. But whether that was Ben Spock's fault or not, I really doubt that. You would have to have seen him amidst all of this permissiveness. This was a Boston Brahmin who had gone to Yale, who had won a Olympic gold medal for sculling, rowing, who always wore a three-piece suit impeccably with a vest and a watch fob in his breast pocket, and who was incapable of swearing or of breaking any of the cultural norms, except he had a deep and abiding belief in freedom and democracy, and that the war in Vietnam was wrong, and that it was wrong to suppress, repress, and discriminate against black people. Those were the only two aberrations in his otherwise perfectly
establishment.
As he would say, he was raised as an Episcopalian, and Reverend Sloan Coffin was his mentor at Yale, and he just slipped in these two ways that he believed in freedom and justice. Otherwise, I don't think he was responsible for the permissiveness that has been ascribed to him. I'm well aware of the controversy because he told parents to treat babies and children like people as opposed to trying to train them. And I think the jury is out. I'm not so sure. You know, these days we talk about Republican and Democratic ways of raising kids. Spare the stick, spoil the child. He was certainly against that. He was against corporal punishment. I think most of us probably now agree with that. But the permissiveness of the generation, I think there was a lot more going on. As you say, there was rebellion against the materialism and superficiality. However, you got to look at where you were in history. We had just fought a major world war. We had been victorious. We'd probably, as a country, been the best occupying power in history. We were generous in Germany after the nuclear war that we had with Japan after dropping bombs in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We were also generous in Japan. And we were very proud of our ethics, and we wanted our kids to imbibe them. I think that had a much bigger effect than his book, Baby and Child Care, which I remember I got an inscribed copy. He was just a larger-than-life, wonderful person. I'll just say one more thing about him. The first time I met him, which was when I brought him to my medical school to speak at a group we had called LICE, lunchtime in cultural euphoria. And he came and spoke, and then we had a dinner afterwards. I remember him taking his plates and walking them into the kitchen and washing them and scraping the food off, and then standing there at the kitchen while other people brought their dishes in so he could wash them. And I thought that was, this is trivial, but I thought that was a very Christ-like movement. Everybody else was just waiting for, you know, the help to clean up the dishes, but not Ben Spock. He was washing everybody else's dishes.
Almost like washing the feet of the disciples, but a little bit more practical, really.
A little different.
And so how about your first inklings of Eastern spirituality? One thing I don't believe I see in your book, but you were at Wayne State for medical school?
Yes.
Okay, about what years?
Well, I graduated in 69.
Okay.
I never graduated from, I don't have an undergraduate degree. I never finished my major was philosophy and ethics, but I went right into medical school.
Right. So you were around at Wayne State around 69. I'm just curious if in your more philosophical and spiritual searchings, you came across the Hare Krishna people because their ashram was right there at Wayne on Forest.
I did, and I was certainly curious about the Eastern religions. I was curious about Western religions too. I found myself going to different churches every Sunday, going to different temples and synagogues on Saturday, and so I know that I was really curious, but it didn't go very far, and it couldn't have for me because it was, you know, we were in the middle of the anti-war movement. What was the most moving for me was going to, I could be wrong, but I think it was Methodist Church on Woodward, downtown, Third Methodist Church, second, and that's where I signed up to join the NAACP, and that was the place from which every civil rights march began. And that was the thing that I find missing even today in all of our conversations about social justice today. Those marches were always led by the churches, and it was usually pretty clear that it was going to be, you know, Reverend Sloan Coffin and Reverend Martin Luther King, and we would be listening to people who would be preaching about justice. And so religion and social justice were conflated, commingled, and I haven't felt quite that way in a very long time.
Yeah, there definitely is a different paradigm these days, right?
Yeah.
Different paradigm. Yeah. You were involved in activism at the same, this is also where you might have had a little fun in the hippie movement with the music scene and all of that. You mentioned Garwood Mansion, which I did not know about until I read it in the book, and then I had to look it up. I'm going, how did this exist without me knowing about it back then? Again, you've got a few years on me, but still.
Yeah. Well, you know, when my wife and I were getting married and we were going to have our wedding, we had two weddings. We had a conventional wedding. It was then called the Book Cadillac Hotel, and with a rabbi and a chuppah, and I mean, breaking the glass and all of that. But that didn't really represent who we were at that moment. So we had our hippie wedding, which was on the Garwood Island, which was a little bridge going out to the island, and you could lock it. So we kept the Good Humor truck on the inside of the island, but we anticipated that maybe the police would pay a visit, and we locked the gate. They never actually came. But I brought the president of Wayne State to the party, and without disclosing his identity, I'll tell you, he had a really good time. And we had John Sinclair and part of the MC5 and Savage Grace. And they were playing pretty long. And my grandmother, who, God bless her, was such a wonderful person, her name was Ida Sherman, and she was born in Russia. And we had two bowls of Kool-Aid, and one had a big sign which said, "Don't drink this unless you know this is the electric Kool-Aid," and the other was just the regular Kool-Aid. My grandmother didn't know what electric Kool-Aid was. And at 70, which was a that seemed like very old for me in those days. I passed that myself, but I remember when she told me that Kool-Aid was so good, and she was having such a wonderful time, and she was out there dancing to the MC5, and I thought, my God, this is a pretty interesting wedding.
I would say so. Excuse me while I kiss the sky, grandson.
Exactly.
Listen, you know, this half hour has gone by so quickly, and we haven't gotten to the real meat of your book. So, Larry, I'm going to ask you to please join us next week, and we'll talk about India, and your guru and the wonderful work you did. People, I'm encouraging you, make sure you make it to a radio this time next week, or pick us up online, because it's going to be fascinating. So, Larry, we've got a date next week, same time.
We've got it. Thank you, Fred.
You've been listening to Common Threads here on WGVU. I'm Fred Stella. My guest today has been Larry Brilliant, and he is the author of Sometimes Brilliant, The Impossible Adventure of a Spiritual Seeker and Visionary Physician Who Helped Conquer the Worst Disease in History. I'm Fred Stella. Please join us again next week on WGVU.